From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet the star of the comedy series Rock, Charles Dutton. He's starred on Broadway and appeared in film, but he got his start acting while serving a prison sentence for manslaughter. Also, we meet the president of the National Organization for Women, Patricia Ireland, and find out why she's not interested in endorsing any of the men running for president. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recent reissue of some rare Mozart string duets he never thought he'd hear again. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. News reports from Venezuela now say that as many as 70 people were killed today in a failed coup attempt by rebel paratroopers. Loyal soldiers repulsed a rebel tank attack against the presidential palace, and the coup leaders called on their supporters to surrender. President Carlos Andres Perez suspended constitutional rights after the coup, and about 300 alleged rebels were arrested. Reporter Edward Holland is in Caracas. He said the coup appeared to have little or no civilian support.
There were some television reports of civilian unrest in Caracas this morning and early this afternoon, which was put down by police, attempts at looting, that sort of thing. However, the coup, while it involved several different army units, didn't have any apparent support among the civilian population. There have been no civilians detained, and in that sense, it doesn't seem as if it's likely to continue.
Reporter Edward Holland in Caracas. Andres Perez's government has been at odds with the military over a border dispute with neighboring Colombia and over military pay. The chairman of the Federal Reserve said today that he believes the economy will respond to the latest round of interest rate cuts and begin to rebound by the second quarter of the year. Fed Chief Alan Greenspan said he thinks that interest rates have been cut enough to get the economy moving, but he added that the central bank is prepared to cut again if it's needed. The Fed chairman also said that he believes the best way to improve the nation's productivity is to improve the savings rate. He said the best way to do that is to reduce the government's deficit spending. The State Department announced today that it's considering steps to revise its economic sanctions against Haiti's five-month-old military government. The moves are intended to shift the burden of sanctions from the poor to wealthier Haitians, many of whom support the military. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The Bush administration may soon retarget its economic embargo against Haiti because it's hurting poor Haitians the most. Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs Bernard Aronson said last night on the McNeil Lair News Hour that economic sanctions may have to be directed more against Haiti's military rulers.
It is hurting the bad guys too little and hurting innocent people a little too much. And we, and I think other governments, are going to try to retarget it and focus more on those who are financing the coup and try to relieve the suffering of some of the ordinary people.
Among the measures now being considered are a freeze on Haitian assets in the U.S. and visa restrictions on Haitians identified as supporting the military government. The Treasury Department may also allow individual companies employing workers in Haiti's assembly sector to apply for licenses to resume business. It is hoped this step may ease unemployment among poor Haitians. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
Stock prices surged to a new closing high today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 39 points to close at 3,272. This is NPR. On Friday, the Food and Drug Administration plans to release key documents from Dow Corning Corporation that raise concern over silicone gel breast implants. Dow Corning had promised to release the documents next week, but the FDA says the information is too important to wait. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
These are the now infamous company memos and internal studies that first came to light in a San Francisco court case last year. They include company memos that seem to show Dow Corning scientists knew of implant risks early on, but ignored them. The judge in that case, at Dow Corning's request, issued an order preventing anyone at the trial from releasing the materials to the public. But someone did leak the documents to the FDA, and a month ago, FDA Commissioner David Kessler said they were a key reason behind his call for a moratorium on gel implant use. Since then, there have been other leaks, and news agencies like NPR have reported extensively on the documents. Dow Corning said it was planning to release the papers next week with explanations of their meaning. But the FDA will not wait beyond Friday to give the documents to the public and to foreign governments that have requested them. This is Michael Scholar in Washington.
A new study suggests that few sexually active teenagers are using condoms despite the risk of contracting the AIDS virus during unprotected intercourse. The study was reported in the journal Pediatrics. It surveyed more than 400 sexually active teenage boys in inner-city junior high schools in California and found that very few used condoms. It said one especially alarming finding was that those who had multiple sexual partners were the least likely to use condoms. The study also found that those adolescents who did use condoms were likely to have had three or fewer sex partners and knew that condoms did help guard against infection by the AIDS virus. I'm Corey Flintoff. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. An actor might blow his lines this Sunday night on Rock, but that's part of the risk of doing a live broadcast, and this Sunday's episode will be live. My guest Charles Dutton is the star of Rock. It's a Fox comedy series about a working-class black family. Rock is a garbage collector. His wife is a nurse. Rock's cranky father and unemployed brother live in Rock's house.
Quality engineer. Foreman.
Am I dreaming or are you actually reading the one ads?
Yep.
You're reading the one ads?
No, you're dreaming. Working a crossword puzzle. I need an eight-letter word for quality engineer.
Employed.
Looking at those want ads is a waste of time. All the jobs are there for white people.
What, pop, you know,
if that's
you...
right. Here. Look at this one. Hotel seeks hands-on person with professional appearance and effective communication skills to handle customer relations.
Yeah, so it's an ad for a hotel manager.
If you're white, it is. If you're black, it's for a doorman.
Doesn't sound like a good career move, right?
Charles Dutton came to TV from the stage. He received Tony nominations for his performances in The Piano Lesson and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. He's also appeared in the film Q&A and is in the forthcoming Aliens 3. He co-stars with Denzel Washington in the new movie Mississippi Masala. Dutton is a graduate of Yale Drama School, but you could say his real alma mater is the Maryland State Penitentiary, where he spent 7.5 years. He was sent to prison in 1968 for manslaughter. A little later, we'll hear how Dutton discovered his gift for acting while he was behind bars. First, let's find out how he got to where he is right now. Rock was built around him, but he says he resisted the idea for about 2 years.
I didn't have any desire to do television at all. Stage is and was my first love. And I had a film career staring me right in the face at the time. So, after many discussions about the style of the show, I just never imagined myself, I didn't want to wind up doing a silly kind of sitcom. So basically, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse, and once the creative aspects of the show was agreed upon and a style of the show was agreed upon to my satisfaction, I... set the wheels in motion to do it. And things developed from there, you know.
Did you model the character of Rock on anyone who you know or knew?
No one in particular. This show germinated originally as to be the Black Honeymooners. And with me as the Gleason character and someone else as the Norton character. During many creative discussions, we decided at that time that we would find our own niche and do our own thing. And the character went from, the Gleason bus driver kind of thing to finding his own occupation. And we selected a garbage man. And it took shape from there, you know. The close cropped haircut that I used for the character.
Wait a minute, you have a shaved head, not a close cropped haircut.
Well, right, you're right. Sometimes I let 2-3 days growth grow on it. Like last episode we taped, I had a little hair. But that wasn't necessarily a fixture for the character. That actually came from the movie Aliens 3. that I had just completed before we shot the pilot episode of Rock. And so once I saw tape of the pilot, I had decided that I liked the look. Although this summer I can't wait to grow my hair back, but for the character, I like it.
And when I saw you in Mississippi Marcella, it took me a second to recognize you because of the hair.
Yeah.
Now, I know you want the series to really ring true. I have to mention here that the writer, Stan Daniels, is white, and I wonder if you ever feel that there are things that don't ring true that you want to change because the writer is a white person writing about a black family.
Sure. No, I understand that. It's, Stan Daniels is white, and Stan doesn't write all the scripts. We have three black writers out of seven. We have a black full-time director. We have four black actors, and as far as I'm concerned, nothing goes past me without some kind of sanctioning, whether it's a script or a storyline or whatever. Now the problem with that is, of course, you're going to have white writers who don't know one iota about a black family life, and sometimes I think that can be a fault of white television writers, you know, who may be writing for a series that's set in the East Coast, which they know nothing about, but yet they won't even venture into South Central Los Angeles in broad daylight just to drive by it or drive through it just to see and experience what it may look like. So in that regard, I think it is the fault of many writers. However, on this show, it was clear from the very beginning that our staff of writers did not know anything about the pulse of a black family, and that they were going to need all the help they could get, and that they would appreciate it for myself and the cast and the other writers and the director would help them along the way, assist them in putting things together. But on the other spectrum, you know, Stan Daniels has created a show, and also the executive producers are trying to create a show that involves a family, period. You know, everything that Rock goes through and that family, believe it, white America goes through also.
Well, one of the things that I think makes Rock special is the quality of acting on the program. And two of the actors who are on the show, you had already worked with on stage in The Piano Lesson. And Rocky Carroll, who plays your brother, Carl Gordon, who plays your father. How are you able to bring them? I think a lot of actors would love to choose the actors who work with them on a series, but wouldn't ever be given the power to make that decision.
Well, you know, I had a few prerequisites before agreeing to do the show, and they were what I talked about initially, having some creative control and consultation about the style of the show. But secondly, and foremost, the casting. You know, I felt the initial response with the producers were to surround me with stand-up comics, and that's not to slight any stand-up comic, but I knew for the kind of show I saw in my head, you needed fresh, genuine stage actors to make it work. I asked for them, and I was very fortunate and thankful that that the producers agreed, you know, and nobody's sorry about it now.
You have a live show, a special live show coming up.
Oh, boy, yeah.
You sound a little worried about it. What's it going to be? Why are you doing it live?
I think I say this, and this may sound a little heightened, but I say we're doing a live show because you have a cast that can do it. It started off on taking advantage of a stage-trained cast to be able to pull it off. Of course, we're doing it without a doubt because it sweeps, February sweeps. It fits into the original concept of the show to be risky and daring and different. It's something that hasn't been done in a long time. I like to think of the show in the classic mode of comedies. So in the old Gleason, Jackie Gleason tradition, when he was doing his show live, you know, in the early Gleason shows, you'll see a charged up atmosphere that's not necessarily what you see when we tape a show. Because, needless to say, we stop and start and shoot over again and get this angle. You know, you'll see, you know, from top to the bottom, you know, it'll be, you know, it'll be live shots while we're preparing to go on in the dressing rooms, backstage. You'll see if people are nervous or if they're afraid. And you'll see them actually walk through that door and go on. And then the danger, of course, is if we screw up anything, we have to continue. You know, we have to keep on. So it's a challenge to everybody involved, the technical crew, Fox for taking the gamble, and for the actors who seem crazy enough to want to do this.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charles Dutton, and he stars in the Fox series Rock, which is on every Sunday night. They've got a live show coming up this Sunday. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Actor Charles Dutton is my guest, the star of the series Rock. You've had, as you know, a very extraordinary life. You spent several years in prison and went to reform school as a kid. And you once described it as a great place for an inner-city kid to get to play in the country or something along those lines.
What
did you find to like about reform school?
Well, you know, growing up in the inner city of Baltimore, you know, you didn't get out as a kid. You didn't get out to sort of enjoy the outdoors, you know. You know, I grew up in a housing project. You know, occasionally you may go to summer camp if your folks could afford it, or if it was a free summer camp, you know, one week or 2 weeks in the summer. But when you went to reform school, you were, you know, in a rural area in the country where there were, you know, animals, livestock, and organized sports and three meals a day and two movies a week. And so to me, it was fun. To me, going to reform school was fun. Me and my buddies would actually organize our juvenile activities so that we went to court in early April or May just to spend 3 or 4 months in reform school.
It was like your version of summer camp.
It was a version of summer camp. It really was. And all your friends were there, you know. But what you don't realize as 11, 12, 13-year-old kid, that you're actually being conditioned at an early age to become a ward of the state. So that by the time you leave reform school, you're ready for the next level.
Prison.
You know, well, say if 13 or 14, there's always one more reform school stop, and that's 15 to 16-year reform school. But that's the middle one, and it gets tougher each time. But then you're ready for the next level because it's like the floodgates open, and your friends go to the next level, and then you go to the next level. And after that, you know, you're ready for the big leagues, and that is prison, you know.
Would you explain the story of how you got to prison?
Well, I went to reform school many times as a kid for numerous things. Started at 12 years old for truancy and juvenile delinquency and being ungovernable and incorrigible, all those nice little words they use to describe one's behavior. When I was 17, I killed a guy in a fight. He nearly killed me, and I wrestled a knife from him, and I killed him. See, I lived and he died. That was a long, long time ago, nearly 23, 24 years ago. I had I did 2 years for manslaughter, and I was released, and then I went right back to prison a couple months later for possession of deadly weapons. I was convicted and sentenced to 3 years in prison, and while doing the 3 years in prison, I got into a fight with a correctional officer in the prison and was sentenced to an additional 8 years sentence. So they structured the sentencing, whereas I had to do the 3 year sentence first and then start on the 8 year sentence. So, you know, during that time, after I went back to prison the second time, I was what I consider a total knucklehead. You know, I was anti-authority. I had no respect for authority. I was a radical militant. You know, I really believed that there was going to be an armed overthrow of the United States government, and I was willing to die for that. You know, I was in the Black Panther Party. I was in one of the toughest prisons in the country at that time.
In Maryland?
In Maryland, Maryland State Penitentiary. It ranked in the top five of the toughest prisons in the country at that time. I never considered myself a vicious person. I never considered myself a person who did anything premeditatedly. The incident of the manslaughter charge was a situation where I was 17 years old. And it was just at a party, and a fight broke out, and me and this guy had a nice fight going on, and he pulled a knife and stabbed me several times. I wrestled it away from him and stabbed him.
What was your identity in prison before you became known as the actor and the one who organized the theater group? Who were you before?
Well, I was a troublemaker. Yeah, yeah. I was on the prison administration's hit list. I was beat up, brutalized by the guards, prison guards, more than once in those 7.5 years that I spent. I had my ribs broken, my nose broke, an ankle cracked, 2 fingers broke. I had my head bust 6-7 different times in prison. I had my teeth knocked out. I had my eye lacerated with 22 stitches. Across my eyebrow.
This is all by guards?
Over the course of time. All by prison guards, yeah. I got in a lot of fights in prison, too, with inmates. But once I became politically conscious, the inmate against inmate fighting stopped for me, at least. When I was in my, street stage, mentally, I got in fights with other inmates. But when I started to read in prison, admittedly, I was reading strictly leftist literature, Mao Zedong, Marx and Engels, Lenin. It was through the reading of politics and societies and capitalism and socialism and what makes the world tick, you know, in economically, you know, that I began to understand what my condition was and what these people around me conditions were. And so inadvertently, I began to discover my own humanity by being a radical.
Let me ask you how you got from reading mostly leftist literature to reading plays and getting interested in performing.
Well, in 1972, a girlfriend sent me an anthology of black playwrights. At the time, I had no intention. I thought this decadent, capitalistic cultural exercise, I want nothing to do with it. And the book sat on my shelf in my prison for 4 or 5 months. And finally, I got in a little trouble in prison with a guard, and I was sentenced to six days in isolation, which is a little room with no light, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You were allowed one book to take. And I just reached back and grabbed the book, and I happened to pick that one up, and I read the book from cover to cover by the light that seeped under the door of the room. And it was a light shining in the hallway, and I just would lay down on my stomach at the door, and from the crack of the door, light, and turn the pages of the book, and got a little light to read from. And I was struck by one play that was so hilarious, a satire, a political satire called Day of Absence by Douglas Turner Ward. After reading this play, I had determined that when I got out of isolation, I was going to get the funniest characters in the prison that I knew and get these guys together and form a drama group. And we would put this particular play on at the prison talent show. And I got out of isolation on the sixth day, and I showed this play to a couple of guys. A couple of guys couldn't read, so I told them what the play was about. And the prison talent show came along, and it was a school teacher in the prison who was a local actress, a lady by the name of Diane Weaver. And so Mrs. Weaver, she supervised the group, and we started this drama group, and it changed my life.
Did that change your attitude about prison? Did you start really wanting to get out when you realized that there was something you really wanted to do?
Oh, it sure did. It sure did. And from that point on, I had stopped trying to find out how much time I could do and started trying to find out how much time I didn't have to do. And so I went, you know, I quit school in the seventh grade as a kid. So from that point, I went back and I went to the prison school and got my high school equivalency degree. Then I enrolled in the prison college program and got my 2-year college degree while in prison, an associate's arts degree. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever worried about ending up back in prison, or do you think that that's just out of the question?
Well, I mean, I don't plan to do anything to get me back there. There is nothing that anyone can tell me about prison anymore. I have a PhD in prison life, you know. So there's no reason for me to go back. I don't hang out in the same circles. I'm not in the same company of guys who go in and out. I still have lots of friends who are in prison. They'll be my friends for as long as I'm on this planet. Guys on the street corners in Baltimore, you know, guys who are still using drugs, selling drugs, shooting drugs, and those people will always be my friends, you know. I'm hoping and praying that the ones who are involved in the negative things will eventually retire from it and see their lives in a different light and say, okay, I've had enough, you know. But if they don't, I can't be the one to judge.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you very much.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Terry. You're welcome.
And good luck with the live show on Sunday.
Thank you. We're going to need it. Okay. Thank you.
Charles Dutton is the star of the Fox comedy series Rock. This Sunday night, Rock will be broadcast live. You can also see Dutton in the new movie Mississippi Masala and in the forthcoming film Aliens 3. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Them that's got shall have, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says, and it's still getting new. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. ...1992 marks the 25th anniversary of the National Organization for Women. Coming up, we meet NOW's president, Patricia Ireland, and see what NOW's strategy is this election year. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recent reissue of Mozart and Beethoven duets recorded before World War II. They're so rare, Lloyd says, he never expected to hear them again. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has termed a military move to oust the government of Venezuela outrageous. The coup attempt was believed to be the first of its kind in that country in more than 30 years and came after violent protest over the widening gap between the rich and poor. The South American nation has a huge foreign debt of some $35 billion. The government now says that all those who took part in the coup attempt have either surrendered or have been defeated. Israel's parliament has voted to dissolve itself and hold general elections in June. Patricia Golan reports from Jerusalem that Israeli Prime Minister Shamir has vowed, however, to continue Israeli participation in the Middle Eastern peace process in the meantime.
The formal parliamentary vote comes 2 weeks after the ruling Likud party lost its majority when two right-wing parties walked out of the coalition fearing Israeli concessions in the Middle East peace talks. The opposition Labor Party failed last week to bring down the government in a no-confidence vote, but the two major parties agreed to bring up the scheduled November elections to June 23rd, a decision approved late today by the Knesset. Both Likud and Labor will be holding internal elections before June to choose their candidates for prime minister. Shamir is certain to win his party's vote, but there is a serious threat to Labor leader Shimon Peres. For National Public Radio, this is Patricia Golan in Jerusalem.
A senior nuclear weapons expert in the Soviet Union says that there's a serious risk of nuclear accidents because many arms specialists are leaving their jobs. The expert, Boris Gorbachev, who is not believed to be a relative of the former Soviet president, led a team that designed nuclear warheads. Kevin Connolly of the BBC reports from Moscow.
Mr. Gorbachev's account of the weapons industry in which he worked as a designer for 25 years is an alarming one, which appears to undermine the value of the assurances about nuclear safety offered to Western governments by the republics of the new Commonwealth. He said many Soviet missiles had been designed and built decades ago and were now in an unreliable condition. The technicians trained to maintain them were leaving the newly underfunded defense industry in droves, with the result that the republics may soon be caught in a dangerous position, having no one available to keep the weapons safe, and no one either able to dismantle them. Mr. Gorbachev said there was also a risk that thousands of military officers, distressed and preoccupied by the problems of everyday life in the former Soviet republics, would not be able to maintain the rigorous safety standards needed for the handling of the missiles. That, he said, meant the world faced the prospect of hundreds of Chernobyl-style nuclear accidents.
Kevin Connolly of the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 39 points to close at 3,272.81, a record high. There was heavy trading. This is NPR News. President Bush traveled to Orlando, Florida today to campaign for his budget proposals. Mr. Bush told a meeting of the National Grocers Association that his budget ideas will stimulate the U.S. economy without raising interest rates. He turned aside criticisms from Democrats and his own housing secretary that the plan is filled with gimmicks. Yesterday, in a heated White House meeting, Mr. Bush's plan was challenged by Democratic governors. Today, Colorado Governor Roy Romer said that since states are directly affected by any budget decisions made by the president and Congress, this has to be discussed in public. During a broadcast interview this evening, French President Mitterrand said the visit to France of Palestinian hardliner George Habash was not a serious matter, and he ruled out any changes in his cabinet. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
President Mitterrand said he would not fire any of his cabinet ministers, as opposition politicians have demanded. He said the uproar over the visit of George Habash to Paris had been created by the press. He said the decision to let Habash be treated in a Red Cross hospital here was an error of judgment made by civil servants. He said they viewed Habash's visit as a routine affair, but he said this was a political matter and they should have informed me. Mitterrand was in the Gulf when Habash arrived in Paris last Wednesday. When the president returned home, several top aides who were blamed for the decision were fired. Mitterrand said he will call a special session of Parliament on Friday, and he challenged the opposition to put forward a no-confidence motion against the government. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Congress has moved quickly to extend unemployment benefits to jobless Americans. The House approved the bill by a vote of 404-8, and the Senate did the same on a vote of 92-2. The president has said that he will sign the measure quickly. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This year marks the National Organization for Women's 25th anniversary. My guest is the new president of NOW, Patricia Ireland. Ireland is a lawyer, but her first career was in a profession famous for its sexism. She was an airline stewardess. In fact, it was her challenges to the airline's discriminatory policies that led her to law school. As NOW's president, she must lead the feminist group through an important election year. What's their political strategy this year?
Well, when we look at the issues, and especially the economic issues this year, which are so critical for all of us, we see really that this 1992 election is a once-in-a-decade opportunity to move more women into positions of power. There have been redistricting of the congressional and state legislative district lines have been changed. We have an estimated 100 open seats in Congress. It's a wonderful opportunity to bring new people in. And there is no debate among us that we need to have far more than just 5% women in Congress. We're certainly looking at alternative ways to put women's resources and political energy. One, for instance, in the Louisiana elections in 1991, where we had the two parties offering us Edwards and Duke. Edwards, who even post the Hill-Thomas confrontation thought it was a good joke to say that he and David Duke were both wizards under the sheets, an election where the bumper sticker that I think characterized it was "Vote for the crook, it's important," since Edwards had been indicted several times and yet we wanted to defeat Duke. We created an alternative there. We went down there and recruited unprecedented numbers of women's rights candidates to run for their state legislature. And in building a mass campaign for women's rights candidates, we tripled the number of women in the state legislature. We got the first woman elected lieutenant governor. And, of course, every one of those people who came out to vote for a feminist candidate voted against David Duke. But I could not, using my most persuasive efforts, coax, cajole, or coerce our people to work for Edwards. If we're going to keep our democracy, if we're going to keep voters involved in the electoral process, we're going to have to create some alternatives, whether that is recruiting new candidates, better candidates for the existing parties, or starting a new party free from the kind of corruption and greed and hypocrisy that most people see in the existing structure. I think that that is a direction we have to take.
Do you feel that the Democratic Party has betrayed you?
I don't think there's any question about that. We worked very hard in 1984 and 1986 with the Democrats. 1984 was the only time we'd endorsed a presidential candidate when Mondale and Ferraro ran together. In 86, we worked very, very hard to get the Senate back into the control of the Democrats with the argument that we had to save the Supreme Court. And yet, as each new and more conservative justice went on the court, men who were pledged to support women's rights, Democrats who won with the majority of women's vote and the majority of men voting for their Republican opponent, betrayed us. We look at the Clarence Thomas confirmation as only one in a line of Souter, Kennedy, others who've gone on the court, who mean that the court now, having served for the last 40 years or so as a bastion of protection for individual rights, is now a states' rights court. It's not going to protect individual rights any longer. And I think it was really the last straw for many of us. One of our activists characterized it by saying that the Democrats always come and sweet-talk us the night before the election, but then don't respect us in the morning.
Well, do you think the Democrats have taken the women's vote for granted, or the now vote for granted, I should say?
I think they've taken the women's vote for granted generally, and they have had often a very good platform, which instead of running on, they have run away from.
I'm just curious, with the presidential election coming up and with a restrictive abortion law about to be challenged in the Supreme Court, a lot of people are saying that because the economy is so bad, abortion isn't going to be the same kind of big campaign issue it might otherwise have been, because everybody's really worried more about their jobs and their health insurance and their bills than they are about anything else. Is abortion going to be number one on your list when you go to vote?
The abortion issue will be a key issue in the 1992 elections, and in many races it will be the key issue. I think that as a feminist organization, when we look at candidates, we look at their stand on civil rights, lesbian, gay rights, women's rights, abortion rights, their economic views, a whole package. We're not a single-issue organization. We are looking for people who will support social and economic justice, a clean environment, demilitarization. We're really looking for candidates who will be leaders to take the country into the 21st century. We would like, before we get to the 21st century, to settle the 19th century question of whether women are going to be full citizens and partners with men in this country, including as part of our economic needs, the ability to control whether and when we have children. You can't plan a career, you can't take part in the social and political and economic life of the country if you can't control your own fertility. It is a real core issue, but it's one of many issues that we're working on.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Patricia Ireland. She's the president of NOW, the National Organization for Women. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Patricia Ireland is my guest, the president of NOW. Anyone who is in the public eye has to make a very difficult decision, which is where to draw the line between what is public and what is private. And you recently said something in the press that has been the subject of a lot of controversy, and my question isn't about your private life. It's about where you've decided to draw that line. And if you have any regrets about if you've been redrawing the line after the statement that you made, and the statement was that you've been married for 25 years and live with your husband in Florida, but you spend a good deal of time in Washington as well, working with NOW, and in Washington you have a woman companion. Your private life is your business, and I'm not here to ask you about that, but I'm just wondering about where you've decided to draw the line now between what is public and what is private.
What I've talked about is my family, the people who are important in my life, and I think that that is appropriate public curiosity about who I am, perhaps. Where I draw the line is with the issue, for instance, of sexuality. I don't think it's anybody's business who I have sex with, if anyone, how often, under what circumstances. I do think that most women and men in this country are much more concerned about their families than mine, much more concerned about what NOW is going to do under my leadership to improve women's economic status, to reduce the violence, to help us get access to health care and preserve abortion rights.
Well, given that your own personal life has been the subject of some controversy, and I know how carefully you're following the presidential campaign, what do you make of the way the press has been handling the question of whether or not Bill Clinton had an affair? And do you think it's relevant? Do you think it's anybody's business? Should we be talking about this kind of thing in our presidential candidates?
Well, I think that the issue goes beyond that. The issue of respect for women, how they treat women on their staffs? Who are their advisors? Do they have any women who bring the perspective of women's voices and women's needs to their ears as advisors? Where are they on women's rights issues? Those are so much more relevant than the question of whether someone has had an affair. I think there's also a substantial difference between a person who becomes well known as what's called a womanizer, that is, someone who seems to use women in a way that does show a great insecurity, perhaps on the part of the man, and a certain disrespect for women as well. But I think that the question that has come up around Bill Clinton's campaign is something that we may find as a watershed in moving beyond that the two extremes, the one being the long number of years when the press looked the other way at people in power who had abused their power one way or another, or who had drinking problems, or who were womanizers, and moving into a place where it's put in perspective among a whole lot of other qualifications, a whole lot of other ways to judge their credibility and their honesty and their competence.
Is now going to be endorsing any of the candidates in the primary?
I doubt that we will endorse in the presidential election. We've only done that on one occasion, and frankly, our focus is really on moving more women into positions of policymaking and power.
Why not endorse a candidate, though? Why not put your muscle behind the person who you think is going to do best by women?
Well, frankly, we are tired of settling for the lesser of two evils. We find, for instance, Bill Clinton, who has been regarded as the front runner, does not believe in young women's right to abortion. He is willing to restrict young women's right to abortion. We don't find that acceptable. And so we find that Clinton is flawed as a candidate for us. We want to be able to work for people with our whole hearts, with our whole energy, knowing that we're not going to be betrayed. And the Clarence Thomas nomination made it so clear to us the fallacy of counting on someone else to represent us. We need to be there ourselves at those tables where those decisions are made. And so, again, our focus is to move beyond that 5% glass ceiling of women in the Congress, beyond the 2% women in the Senate, ultimately getting women in the pipeline indeed to run for president and win.
The one problem is if you're counting women in politics, that often someone will appoint a woman to a high-level position, or a woman candidate will run who's basically anti-feminist. You know, not all women in politics endorse a feminist agenda, really endorse issues relating to women's rights and women's health care and so on. So how do you deal with that when you know there's a woman who is running for office, but you really disagree with the platform she's running on?
Well, we're looking for the feminization of power. We're looking to move more women into positions of power because we want our issues to move forward. And so if we have a race where a man is supportive of women's rights issues and the woman isn't, we will endorse the man, and we've done that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
But subject to the same flaws of any gross generalization, we are looking to move more women into power because we have, on the whole, a greater support for women's rights issues. It's not that there's not some very good men in the Congress. There are. It's not that there aren't some women who will vote against us, because there are. But if I had to start in a dark room just picking out a Congress, I would pick 50-50 and go from there. Women have a different experience in life, whether we like it or not. We're the caregivers of the very young and the very old. I just know intuitively if we had 50% women in Congress instead of 5%, family and medical leave would have become law. Child care would have a priority. Health care would have a higher priority. There are areas that women are responsible for in our families. There are areas where we work. We work as health care workers, social workers, teachers. It's just a different perspective. And that perspective is totally missing right now from public policy setting.
My guest is Patricia Ireland, the president of the National Organization for Women. I read about you, and I never know if what I read about people is true or not, but I read that your mother was the first director of the first Planned Parenthood clinic in the town where you grew up?
Yes, my parents were both involved in Planned Parenthood of Northern Indiana and in founding it and working there. And in fact, I come from a long line of very strong women. My grandmother was one of the first women who ever drove in Chicago. The police in the suburb where they lived used to call my grandfather and say she he had to get her off the road, and he would say, why? I thought Beth was a good driver. I taught her to drive myself. And the response was, well, she's a good driver, but all the men who are so startled stare at her, and then they rear-end each other. So she should stop driving. It was a time when women were pregnant. It was called their confinement, and they weren't supposed to go outside. Well, we can even remember in our generation women who, when they started to show, lost their jobs as teachers if they were pregnant. My grandmother said, phooey on that, I need exercise, made her own maternity clothes and scandalized the neighborhood by going for a walk every day of her pregnancy. So I come by this naturally, I think.
You are now the head of a national organization for women. You are very interested in getting more women into elected office. Do you have any interest yourself in being one of those women?
No, I really think that my role is best out here taking pot shots rather than up there dodging bullets. I do want to encourage us to also be very supportive of the women who are in politics, and I think that I can help do that better from here.
Patricia Ireland, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Patricia Ireland is the president of the National Organization for Women. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Tonight, a lot of news stories, and this story from Minnesota. 4,000 guns have been turned into fire stations in Minneapolis and Hennepin County. People brought in guns for $50 cash, no questions asked. The supply exceeded the expectation there. I'll talk to the president of Toyota, Georgetown, Kentucky, about the Camry that they make there, and about statements by politicians in Japan concerning the quality of the American workforce. The Georgetown plant president says his American workers are as good as or better than Japanese workers. He says he's confused about why these statements are being made in Japan. He's complained to the Home Office, but he says not to the Japanese government.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz was happy to find a rare recording of Mozart and Beethoven duos and sonatas reissued on a new CD. They were recorded in Europe before World War II. It's been years since Lloyd first heard these recordings, but he says the performances are as good as he remembers them.
When I was in college, my favorite teacher used to invite students back to her apartment. The campus was in Queens, but she lived in Greenwich Village. Some days after class, a phalanx of shaggy undergraduates would accompany her home on the subway. We'd sit on her living room floor at her feet, and she'd read us contemporary poetry and play us records. I think this was the real beginning of my musical education. One old album of 78 she particularly loved included Mozart's two duos. These unusual chamber pieces for violin and viola are more serious than you think they're going to be. Rich, mature, ambitious works. They are seldom performed, partly because the violin and viola make an odd combination for a live concert. I've never heard a recorded version that ever approached the largeness of these old performances. The violin in both duos was played by the elegant Polish-Jewish violinist and conductor Simon Goldberg. The violist in the first duo was the distinguished British player Frederick Riddle. In the second duo, the violist was no less than the composer, Paul Hindemith. As far as I know, these performances were never transferred to LP, and after my teacher died, I never expected to hear them again. Now they've been reissued by Music and Arts. Listen to the Andante Cantabile of the second duo with Goldberg and Hindemith. The duos are actually a bonus on this album. The featured works are the series of Mozart and Beethoven violin sonatas recorded by one of the finest chamber music teams of the pre-World War II era, Goldberg and the Hungarian pianist Lily Krauss. The most dramatic episode in their partnership occurred when they were touring with their families in the Far East during World War II. They were all captured by the Japanese and interned in a hard labor camp in Java. Goldberg was allowed to play the violin, but Krauss said she was not permitted to play the piano. Both had substantial careers after the war, but Krauss especially never regained her former refinement and resilience. Goldberg's post-war recordings as a conductor, violinist, and chamber musician are long out of print, but they remain admired collector's items. Krauss died 5 years ago, but Goldberg, at the age of 82, is still teaching at the Curtis Institute in Philadelphia. Here's one of their most beautiful collaborations, Beethoven's Last Violin Sonata. Here's the jubilant yet touching finale. I hope you hear why I'm so happy it's in print again.
Lord Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed an album of Mozart and Beethoven featuring the Goldberg-Krauss duo on the Music and Arts label. Fresh Air's engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, and Thad Kirk. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our director is Chris Spurgeon. Today's show is directed by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet white South African novelist André Brink. He was the first Afrikaner to have a novel censored by the government. Also, phone sex. We talk with Nicholson Baker about his new novel, Vox. It's one long, erotic, expensive conversation between a man and a woman on a 900 talk line. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.